All right, a few announcements before we begin. I assume everyone probably knows Pete got called out of town, so it doesn't appear that his father's doing well, so you might pray for him. He was planning on going next week anyway, but that apparently got changed. Secondly, of course, next Saturday at 10, if you're inclined to apply, meet at Rich's and dress up in suits, apparently. You understand that. No, bring your bathing suit, I guess. And thirdly, just a reminder, 2 weeks from today is the 25th, and then we will have one Bible class that Sunday morning, and then break down, and we will be leaving on vacation. So just to remind you, that's a couple of weeks away. Okay, let's make sure you're in fellowship and consider continue on here. Wrap this up and have your notes before you. We'll be getting back into chapter 7 here. K here is where we stopped out. We recognize that Satan may, in the cosmos, can prosper those that reject the truth because they are no longer a threat to them at a certain level, and so they're more willing to align themselves with the negative believer. Certainly than they are with a positive believer that withstands them and exposes them for what they are. K, another danger that exists for the positive believer is to not recognize the true nature of positive volition, which may experience periods of difficulty, failure, and spiritual struggle, but remains positive. That's the one big issue here, that ultimately we can't know. All we can do are make judgments based on the facts before us. And if the person is going to recover, well, God certainly knows. We may have to make unpleasant applications during some time when dealing with them. But ultimately, people can pull out of this. Again, we have, I think, in this about equal numbers of biblical examples of people who pulled out of it and people who didn't. The ones who didn't get the most press, unfortunately. But we know that David went through a period like this and ultimately recovered. Solomon would have recovered. So some of these people, Jacob went through his life very much out of the directive will of God with respect to his geography, very much out of the directive will of God with how he approached the issue with Esau and the issue of the firstborn, very much out of fellowship in a lot of cases when dealing with Laban and all of that. And yet Jacob ultimately makes it spiritually. But these things took their toll. I mean, if you listen to Jacob at the end of his life, when he's standing there before Pharaoh and talking, he doesn't talk like somebody who's really had a good go of it. A few and unpleasant have been the days of my sojournings, he says. So that doesn't sound like a guy who's really had a lot of fun at this. And one of the issues, of course, in dealing with this is that at some level, not every day is not just Funsville and all of that, but at some level, the Christian way of life has its periods of pleasantry and fun. If it was all just misery and despair and gloom, who would even be interested remotely? And plus that, I don't think is the nature of God. As much as God is righteous and all of that, it appears God wants his creatures to enjoy themselves. And in fact, provides everything at some level so they can. So L, therefore, one must be very careful in being too quick to pass spiritual judgment and categorize another believer as a reversionist without taking the necessary time and making the necessary observations. Like the priest, you would have to take whatever time is necessary. And obviously, again, certain big things come into play here. If they're not in Bible class, they're suspect immediately. They're immediately a suspect of, as a reversionist if they've blown out of class. So again, that would involve them doing several things, not just rebounding, but humbling themselves and making all kinds of adjustments. So M, by definition, those that have been exposed to sound teaching repudiate that teaching by rejecting various doctrines and abandon face-to-face teaching are reversionists. Whatever else they claim to be doing, whatever motions or gyrations they go through, they don't fool me. And they shouldn't fool you. And since such is the case, several areas are quite necessary and important to maintain phase two spiritual momentum and should be monitored carefully. One, of course, attendance in Bible class, Hebrews 11:25, not forsaking, I believe that should be 10:25, by the way, not forsaking the assembling of yourselves together. as the habit of some is. People get into habit. It starts with missing here and there. Then it develops into a habit. That's one of the dangers. Two, attitude towards the pastor, teacher, and other authorities. Hebrews 13:17. That's one of the challenges for everybody. Anybody under any authority. Obviously, we know what the doctrine pretty much teaches. Orientation to authority is God's will for our lives. Whether that authority is a pastor, a boss, a husband, a teacher, whatever it is in life. A parent, all that. Hebrews 13:17, obey your leaders and submit to them, for they keep watch over your souls as those who will give an account. Let them do this with joy and not with grief. Obviously, there are some people you watch over them and you're just going to give an account with grief. They didn't make it, Lord. I'm sorry. I did the best I could, but they didn't make it. Three, attitude toward doctrines, particularly those that expose or irritate an area of weakness. As Jesus talks about, the light comes into the world and men reject the light. Why? Because they prefer the darkness. We have to watch that the light doesn't begin to irritate us. That's the challenge. If you are making excuses for your area of weakness and not acknowledging that it is exactly that, an area of weakness that I have to work on. I have to maintain intensity in regard to it. John 3:20, for everyone who does evil hates the light and does not come to the light for fear that his deeds will be exposed. And that, again, I recognize this by interpretation, refers to unbelievers. But I think a similar principle is true for believers. You have to watch out. If the teaching suddenly starts to irritate you, well, why is that? What is the doctrine new? Has it changed in some way? Or is it irritating you because it is kicking against an area of your STA? Four, attitude towards the faith, the good deposit, which is to be guarded against attack, especially in these last days. 2 Timothy 1:13-14. And again, if I didn't think for a second that I had sufficient training, sufficient leadership in my previous history, that provided me basically a sound doctrinal grid. One of the things is that you recognize sound doctrine. The truth has a ring to it. I know the Fundies never provided me a sound doctrinal grid. They just didn't. They weren't even close. They really weren't in the ball game, to be honest. And yet, I got mine at Maranatha Church. Now, I've talked to Jack about this, and we've discussed it, and if we find things out here, one of the things we were taught was think for yourselves. Don't parrot me. Don't be a clone of somebody else. And that was one of the things we were always accused of. I remember that even when I was still there at Maranatha. Oh, we can't talk to you. You guys just parrot what Jack says. No, I don't. Even when I was there, I didn't. You didn't know me very well. I don't do it out here, but to the extent that it's sound and correct, I don't feel the need to reinvent the wheel. So we have a basic sound doctrinal grid that we have to protect and watch out for. It's coming under attack on all fronts. 2 Timothy 1:13-14. Retain the standards of sound words which you have heard from me. In the faith and love which are in Christ Jesus, guard through the Holy Spirit who dwells in us the treasure which has been entrusted to you. The treasure entrusted to you is literally the good deposit. Doctrine has been put on file with me for safekeeping. I'm just keep it safe to teach it to you and to make sure that I maintain the integrity of the grid. That doesn't mean you don't stop and think through things or you don't reconsider, you don't reevaluate. Your thinking changes as you grow. As I said earlier, first session, I thought one thing about the doctrine of reversionism at one time. Gave me an out where I didn't have to deal with my negative family. I don't think it does now. I think you have to address those other issues. That there are two doctrines here which would appear to be in conflict. Which one do I apply? Well, it depends on the situation at some level. So Jude 3 also deals with that principle of the good deposit. here called the faith. Beloved, while I was making every effort to write to you about our common salvation, I felt the necessity to write to you appealing that you contend earnestly for the faith that is once for all handed down to the saints. See, there are some people, they get out under their STAs, they're emotional, they want to chuck the entire doctrinal grid and start again from scratch. Hey, I'm not saying we're perfect. I'm just saying I know enough to know I'm not going to chuck it all and start again from scratch. We're not that messed up. I mean, having been exposed out there to what's available over the years, and I don't think they've improved since the, you know, since I was exposed to them in the 70s. I mean, I've been to Church of Christ. I've been to Nazarene churches. I've been to Baptist churches. I've been to Catholic churches. I've been to these charismatic type churches. And I saw what they taught. I was there. I was face to face with them. I heard their doctrines. Once I heard sound doctrine and recognized what a sound doctrinal grid was, well, it was very different than what I'd heard before. So again, we have the deposit. We are to guard it. It doesn't mean it's perfect, but we do our best to maintain the integrity of it and to update it where we find any little error, any little thing that can be improved upon. Well, we'll try to improve upon it as we're led through the text. But the answers are in the text. The answers are in the doctrines that we study. The answers aren't, you know, somewhere else, and certainly not creative exegesis. And then five, consistent STA activity, which one does not want to confess or address. When you find yourself not applying 1 John 1:9, that's a danger sign. You say, well, I feel guilty. I don't want to confess my sin. Well, you better get over it and confess it. The guilt is there to lead you to confession, to deal with it before God. And then once God has forgiven you, you forgive yourself and you move on. Sometimes that's the harder thing. You sin, you let yourself down, you fail. And guess what? God forgives you. Why can't you forgive yourself and move on? There's no point in beating yourself up after a point. Doesn't serve any purpose. Well, Paul's advice to Timothy is sound advice for one that desires to avoid the pitfall of reversionism. Certainly in context, we know this applies to communicators by interpretation. But by application, all believers, they're not going to have to do the teaching thing. But pay close attention to yourself, and we might even say to the teaching. Persevere in these things. The things you hear in Bible class, stick with them. You're not going to go wrong in the long term with this. I'm fully convinced whatever problems we have, the basic system works. And whatever tweaking it may need, it does not require a wholesale trash in on the trash pile and start again. I don't see, as some people do, I don't see doctrine as a failed experiment. The teaching of sound doctrine in the last day. Some people see it as a failed experiment, I think. And that's too bad for them. So one, paying close attention to yourself means that one consistently monitors STA activity and is consistent in applying rebound. You got to, and don't rationalize your areas of weakness and say, I don't have them, or they're not real. Say them, acknowledge them for what they are. That may be painful, unpleasant at the moment. But guess what? In the long term, it's going to keep you more on spiritual balance. Because if you start getting off balance by rationalizing STA activity, then it becomes easier and easier to do. And then pretty soon you're not seeing anything clearly. That's the danger of that. Two, paying close attention to the teaching demonstrates tenacity with regard to the doctrine being taught. And once again, we have held to a principle that the pastor doesn't have to be perfect. Well, first, there's no man that is, so that's pretty easy to figure out. But is he teaching truth? Is he teaching the doctrine at a high level? Even my enemies have acknowledged, yes, he is. Well, that's just dumb, then. You've just shot yourself in the foot. Yes, he is. Okay, well, then fine. Then you need to be tenacious in regard to that doctrine and sticking with it. Three, persevere in these things means that one is to continue with the path of that form of teaching to which you have been committed. Romans 6:17. Again, I am convinced that we have a generally sound form and a generally sound function. And it works, given enough time. If believers are positive, this method works. This allows for all kinds of things the fundy doesn't allow for. It allows for the privacy of the priesthood. It allows for you to time and space to grow. It allows grace. That's the nature of a grace ministry. We'll grace you out till it becomes impossible to do so. And then we might even grace you out once or twice after that. But again, there is a sound fundamental form we have. Thanks be to God that though you were slaves of the STA, you became obedient from the heart to that form of teaching to which you were committed. And four, these things will guarantee phase two, deliverance from the domination of the sin nature, as well as phase three, vindication at the Bema Seat. And that, largely, is all you can hope for, to make it through this life intact, with your integrity intact, spiritually advancing, laying hold of rewards through the principle of divine good production, and then ultimately completing your course by being one of those few that is running at the end, whether it's your phase two death or the rapture, that is advancing. You're in a marathon. You may be down to a crawl, but you're still moving. You may just be walking. You may be trotting. You may be one of those rare believers that sees the finish line and breaks into a dead-out sprint. Well, after a marathon, you don't feel like sprinting, trust me. But yet the great marathoners can do that. The last 500 yards they'll do is a dead-out sprint. You ever sprinted 500 yards recently? I'd be puking after about the first 50. And so, again, we want to be successful. This is a real danger. We warn believers about it. And again, back to the text, because of what Solomon said there about the misplaced confidence that comes through wickedness, comes through evil. And people get the idea that when they are doing wrong, that God is somehow for them, and that God is behind all this. Well, now let's move into a very misunderstood text. And just reading it cursorily, I can understand why it's misunderstood. But you only have certain options here. Does Solomon really hate women? Well, I know I've heard over the years I do. That's been a constant complaint. You don't like women. I love women. I'm not a big fan of horsey women. But I think women as a gender are just fine. They don't bother me in the slightest. Over the years, I've learned that, you know, the world's a much better place with women. God, if it was all men, can you imagine what it'd be like? God help us all. Turn the world over to men. I don't think it would be any improvement whatsoever. I think we would be far the worse off for it. And I've heard all the old jokes, where would we be without Eve? Back in the garden. Yeah, alone. Actually, we wouldn't be here. Adam would be there. There would be no procreation. There would be no human race. So, again, I've heard all the jokes. I've listened to the criticisms. And I don't think Solomon is a woman hater. I know I'm not. I'm sure Solomon was not, in fact. I think if one would argue anything, Solomon tended to love women in a very physical way. And 1,000 of them, at least, that we know about. And God only knows the ones we don't know about. Well, I put a question mark here because, number one, I don't think he really is. And I discovered. Now Solomon gets into, to kind of get you back here with the text. Now, I know we've been off on this reversionism thing for a while. But in verse 23, I tested all this with wisdom. So he basically is kind of back to his initial premise here of what he told you he was going to do in the beginning. That I was going to embark on this experiment. I was going to come to some ultimate answers. And I was going to do this by means of wisdom. And I set my mind, and this comes directly from chapter 1, verse 17. I set my mind to know wisdom, to know madness, and to know folly. And I used wisdom as sort of my sounding board and as my springboard to this pursuit of the real answers in life. What is it that we're missing? And essentially, what Solomon is doing, I think you hopefully have figured out by now, is that at the end of his life, as an old guy, Solomon has looked back, and he's observed his whole experience. And he's observed this little experiment he did by trying to figure everything out. And he's observed his life, and he knows now, experientially, he knows now what the younger generation doesn't know. And that is where all the dead ends are. And Solomon has basically said, everything is a dead end. There isn't anything that really provides a real solid answer for everything in life. And it's not as though Solomon was dumb. It's not as though Solomon didn't try. It's not as though he didn't experiment with everything at his disposal. And he had his experiment knew no bounds, literally. So he could check everything out. So I tested all this with wisdom. as my plan was, and I said, I will be wise. Here he uses wisdom in two distinct ways. Wisdom would be the wisdom tradition of Israel, what the wisdom thinking type mentality would tell you. That, okay, here's what I saw. I observed this phenomenon, and I bounced it off of what wisdom said about it. Okay, this lets me draw some conclusions now. Does the wisdom tradition hold up in every case? No, it doesn't. No, it doesn't. Is it generally sound? Well, sure. But does it always hold true? No, it doesn't always hold true. And then the second use here, I will be wise, is essentially his deal of saying, I'm using wisdom to try to attain this ultimate answer I want. That what's life all about? Now, don't you think that that's what, hopefully, the younger generation kind of at least wonders about and thinks about? What's life all about? Why am I here? What's the point of my experience? What am I to gain from this? Is there anything to be gained from this? Is this just an exercise in futility? Everything is futile, Solomon says. He says everything's an exercise in futility. That man exists on this backdrop of the world. And here's humanity. The world itself appears infinite. It appears like it goes on forever. The world appears eternal. The wind blows. Today it's blowing pretty good. And then it'll stop and then it'll blow again. It'll change directions. It'll go around. It keeps blowing and never stops. And it's going to rain and the river's going to run into the sea, but the sea doesn't get full. And the world just goes on and on and on as it always has. A generation comes and a generation goes. A generation is showing up. There's babies being born today. And a generation is dying. There are people in the emergency room facing their last few breaths. Or at home or wherever they are. And so there's this constant transition, but nothing appears to happen. Humanity lives sort of through this backdrop of eternality, but with no real progress that we can see. Everything that's been done has already been done. Man isn't discovering millions of new things every day. I mean, in some ways, people think, well, technology is really advancing. I don't know that it's advancing that much. Although, I ought to send this out. Jack sent me an interesting, funny email. Things that will never happen. And one of the things that they said would never happen, they said, there's no way anybody would ever be interested in making copies of their business. And so, you know, the guy at IBM told him this will never work, and he went out and founded Xerox. Well, you know the rest of the story. Man will never make it to the moon. And people make all these kinds of statements, and they say, this will never happen. One of the statements was, there's no way a computer will ever weigh less than 1.5 tons. You like that? And there was another one that, there's no way people would ever want a computer in their home. Now can you imagine living without one? So there's all these statements people make, but do they explain life to us? No. And Solomon says, I went through life and I found myself wondering, what's this all about? And of course, all of this was in some regards designed to get to his younger audience, to get their attention. This is all remote. It's exceedingly mysterious. Who's going to figure it all out? I can't figure it all out. I'm the wisest guy that's ever lived. So I directed my mind to know, to investigate, and to seek wisdom and an explanation, to know confidence of folly and the insanity of foolishness. And I discovered. Now here we have a positive discovery. Here is one thing Solomon did find. For all his looking, for all his answers, what did he observe? Well, first, human nature was not off limits in his discussion, obviously. And humans were as much a subject of his studies as the environment around him was. Because, obviously, humans populated his world, just as they populate ours. So now here we get one of his first real discoveries. What did he find for all his looking? I discovered more bitter than death, the kind of woman whose heart is snares and nets. And the New American Standard here has rightly supplied, as I see it, the words here, kind of. If, I don't know if they're in your particular version, but or maybe I supplied them. I'll have to check. It's not in my copy here. But I don't think he's talking about all women, for one thing. First, this does not categorize all women. All women aren't this way. I discovered is a wow here, and we're going to see this a lot. He suddenly starts using this word, matzah. And that means exactly that, to find something. You're looking for something and you find it. And Solomon says, I wasn't necessarily looking for this, but here's what I did find. And literally, and the idea here, he's got a calactive participle. And finding. Why does he use the participle here? Normally you would expect a cal perfect, and I found. Or I discovered. Well, the idea here is I kept on discovering. This wasn't his conclusion is not the result of isolated observation. His conclusion is a result of repeated observation. And what did Solomon see in women? Well, first, let's ask ourselves this. What kind of women did Solomon surround himself with? Beautiful women. Right? No, Solomon went out and got a bunch of dogs. No, he got beautiful women. No doubt, the most beautiful women on the planet. 1,000 of them. 700 wives, 300 concubines. But what kind of women were they? Put yourself in their place. You're a female. You're in a harem. There's already 150 wives, let's say. You're 151. And how are you going to handle that niche? How are you going to go about it? Do you think there was any infighting among these women as they sought to gain Solomon's attention or advance their cause or whatever else? Well, of course there probably was. That would just be human nature. If you had the same situation with 1,000 men, you'd have infighting, would you not? Do you ever watch these shows? I don't watch them. The reality shows, like House or Big Brother or whatever. There's all this infighting constantly on these shows. Apprentice, they're undermining each other. The Mole, that's a good one. I want to tell you. They tell you right off one of these people's scummy. Well, I don't watch that stuff, but I'm just saying I know it's out there. Well, one of the things you observe when you throw a bunch of people into an environment is there's going to be some infighting. And so Solomon, no doubt, experienced this to a fair degree because of the nature of his harem. Now, I'm not saying he was right for having the harem. I'm just saying it's a fact that he did. What I think about it's really irrelevant at a certain point. Because while it was forbidden by the Mosaic law, God apparently let Solomon get away with it. But what kind of price did he pay for doing all this? That's another whole issue that I want to keep before you. What price did he pay for doing all this? Well, I kept on discovering. I did. Personal pronoun here, ani. I was discovering. Bitter, masculine singular attitude of mar, M-A-R. Of taste, the word means exactly that, bitter. Figuratively, it's used of the emotional response that one has to something unpleasant or destructive. Bitter from death, literally. This is the comparative of the Hebrew. You got the preposition men plus the word maweth. M-A-W-E-T-H. More bitter than death. What is more bitter than death? You got the sign of the direct object, so you can't miss it. I mean, it's set apart in the text for you here. Here's the object. What's more bitter? Isha. I-S-H-A-H. Isha. And actually, you know what? That's got a doubling dot in it. It should really be I-S-H-S-H-A-H. The woman. I discovered the woman. Now, what makes me think, one, there are interpreters out there that see this as referring to all women. All women are this way. First, I would think personal experience would tell you that all women are not this way. Some women are this way, not all women. And what you have here is you have a relative particle. I discovered more bitter than death. A woman which she. And this which she, which follows, you got the relative particle I share, A-S-H-E-R, and then the pronoun, third feminine singular, of he, H-I-Y. Of which she, i.e., which woman, which kind of woman is better, I think, here. The kind of woman. And then you got here, traps or snares, is the first one, matzod. M-A-T-S-O-D-H. Traps or snares, one would use when stalking prey. It's also used, say, of a trap like the siege works when they laid up against the city. That's seen in Ecclesiastes 9:14. But it talks about, they've translated it there, actually, large siege works. Because context says this is a trap laid against the city, so they've made an interpretative translation here. So traps and nets, literally. Masculine plural noun of Kerem. C-H-E-R-E-M. The plurals here, again, suggest repeated action, habitual action. I discovered a woman traps and nets, snares and nets, they've translated here, that she has a lot of these. This isn't an isolated thing. Snares and nets her heart, literally. Third fit masculine singular noun construct of lave. Snares and nets whose heart is snares and nets, and whose hands are chains. He leads off of these, again, the masculine plural noun of esur, E-S-U-R. Three times, and this word means the bands or chains one uses to bind a prisoner. Chains, her two hands. You got the feminine dual noun construct plus the third feminine singular suffix. Her two hands. A one who is pleasing to God will escape from her. But the sinner will be captured by her. Good to the faces of Elohim, literally, one who is pleasing to God. The cal active participle of tov. Here, good, it can mean favorable, but I take it here, obviously, if one is good before God, you're talking a moral issue now. God views people in terms of their morality. To the faces, preposition inseparable, preposition lamed here, plus the masculine plural noun construct of panet. To the faces is before or in the sight of. A one who is pleasing in the sight of God, the Elohim, definite article plus Elohim, will be delivered, niphal imperfect of malat, M-A-L-A-T. The niphal is passive, and so niphal means to be delivered, to be saved or spared. Or, since it's not used in the cal, it may be deponent in the Hebrew, and you would translate this, will escape, which they've done in the New American Standard. Will be delivered or will escape, either way. The difference would be how much active time you have to spend trying to get away from this type of woman. He will be delivered from her. From her, preposition men plus the third feminine singular suffix. From her, the woman in view. And I don't think, again, the class of woman in view. I don't think it's a specific woman. I don't think it's all women. I think it's just a certain segment of female population is like this. But you got a wow here in an adversative sense. The sinner, cal active participle of kata. And this means, again, one who misses the mark. The one who's not pleasing in God's sight. The one who's good in his sight is opposed to the sinner. Well, what would make God pleased with people? One would have to ask. If one is pleasing in God's sight, how does one get to be pleasing in God's sight? And the sinner, the one who misses the mark, what mark does he miss? He misses the mark of pleasing God. And so, in the angelic conflict, he's kind of fair game out there. And the one missing the mark will be captured by her. Niphal imperfect of Lakad. L-A-K-H-A-D-H, Lakad. To capture, to seize, or to take a city. Figuratively here, it's used of being entrapped or ensnared by setting a trap. The sinner, the one who misses the mark, will be captured by her. So the sinner is just viewed as a prey that this type of woman sets her sights on. See, there's a type of woman out there that has an agenda, at the bare minimum, has an agenda. And what is the agenda of some women? The agenda of some women is to dominate men. Now, this isn't all women, but this is a part of the female STA. All women probably have to fight it from time to time. The danger of the female STA is that of usurping authority. That's the challenge for a female. She's got an extra authority. I didn't give them to you. God did. And so don't blame me. But you got an extra authority. Now, what's the danger? You want to usurp this authority. You want to overrule this authority. I think every woman has to fight it at some level, but some women give in to it. Some women are characterized by this desire and willingness to do what they have to do to dominate a man. And then, of course, God help the rest of us men if she's successful. Because once a woman gets that kind of a power over a man, she assumes every other man's going to be fodder for her little deal. And guess what? Then they run up against guys like me. Women who've used to having their way. And they can't have their way with me. Because I won't let them. And I'm not getting sex from them, so I don't care. Whereas you may have this guy wrapped around your finger because you got sex. Not that women would ever use sex as a weapon. Yeah, right. Okay, then why that song, Sex is a Weapon? Because people do that. Women, I'm not against all women here. I'm against a particular category of women, just like I think Solomon was. Because there's a particular category of women that's bad news. Just like there are particular categories of men that are bad news. They're not all the same. And to try to make them all the same is not a good idea. But we got to face some unpleasant spiritual realities here. What caused the fall? Adam's choice to listen to Eve. That's what caused the fall. Adam's choice, we're still going to lay it on Adam. By one man, the sin nature entered into the world, and death through the sin nature, spiritual death. But what did God tell Adam? Because you have listened to the voice of your wife. God made no secret out of it. And so you have what now this sets up the potential for abuses on both sides. And I know abuses exist on both sides. So as much as I can, while I'm dealing with a passage here that isn't specifically quote about men. By the way, this passage is not flattering to men either. When he gets into the latter part of this, what I am seeking, verse 28, I have not found. I have found one man among 1,000, but I have not found a woman among all these. So are men significantly better? No. Well, if you only find 1 out of 1,000, no. Not really. They're not significantly better. But you can find that one. So again, the question becomes, when he says, I'm still seeking, I have not found, what is it he's looking for in men and women that he makes this kind of a comment? And what is it that he's seeing in men and women that leads him to make this kind of a comment? Well, point one here, let's start into this today anyway. A misogynist, derived from the Greek verb miseo, to hate or to have a strong aversion, and the noun gune, a female or a woman, is a term for a man who hates women. So, simply defined, it's just a man who hates women. Two, as one might imagine from a cursory reading of verse 26, this verse has provoked some interpreters, not only feminist interpreters, to label Solomon as a misogynist. So how could he say this about women? Well, let me ask you women this. Have you ever met a woman like this? A dominant woman that tries to get around and control her man, manipulate him? I'll bet you have. The danger of that is you might succeed. And they do succeed sometimes, unfortunately. Well, three, there are two distinct types of feminist interpreters. And here at some level, we offer some apologetic as to why we approach this the way we do. Not by ignoring the critics out there. I'm going to acknowledge what the critics have said and what they are saying still to this very day about these verses. But I think they have some fundamental problems to start with. And not because they're female. That's not their only problem. One, what are females doing trying to tell men how to interpret the Bible? There's a fundamental problem there because you don't have any as far as I've been able to see, you don't have women in the office of pastor, teacher, or deacon. Not that the deacon has to interpret the Bible, but again, because they've rejected certain things, they also reject a lot of other doctrines to go along with this. They have to in order to support their position. So there are two types of feminist interpreters. The more radical feminist interpreters, and by the way, feminist interpreters aren't always female. So don't misunderstand that when I say feminist interpreters to read females here only. They're males that are feminist interpreters. Sick, weird, twisted males, but males nonetheless. And then the somewhat more conservative feminist interpreter. For while both are in error, the more radical feminist interpreter asserts the realities of the historical situation of the Bible indicate the need for an entirely new hermeneutic. In other words, the radical feminist interpreter says, our whole system of hermeneutics is wrong. We have been interpreting the Bible wrong. We have got to go back and find a new way to interpret the Bible, which allows for my interpretation. Well, that's all kind and good, except for the fact that it's wrong. If we didn't have sound hermeneutical principles. And if you ever want to read a book on hermeneutics, it'll bore you to tears probably, but if you're interested, I've got one. The guy's actually good. He does a real good job on it. Unfortunately, the guy is a liberal and doesn't even apply his own rules of interpretation to his own exegesis. But it's called Protestant Biblical Interpretation by Bernard Rand. And it basically sets up the whole point of why we interpret according to the literal, historical, grammatical viewpoint. So, five, they assert that the Bible is thoroughly permeated by a patriarchal, misogynist viewpoint of the world in which it was written. Since men ran the world, the Bible was written by men. Therefore, the Bible only reflects man's views. That's their view. Now, first, I don't find that to be true even on the surface, that the Bible only reflects men's views. And I don't find, for instance, even a cursory study of marriage and the husband and wife dynamic in the New Testament, even reading Paul's views, who was a man the last time I checked, even reading Paul's views, I don't see Paul as being biased against women. I read his stuff and it's very even-handed to me. And Paul's teaching, when properly understood, to me would eliminate abuses on both sides, if it's applied. I mean, properly understood and applied, I think Paul's teaching covers the whole principle of women and men and marriage and does it very even-handedly. I don't see Paul being down on women. I see Paul saying, I do not allow women to be teachers or to operate in positions of authority in the local church. But believe me, women, that may not necessarily be a bad thing. I mean, what job do you really want in the local church? That doesn't mean you can't apply, can't lay up SG3, can't do all kinds of things. Paul was very complimentary, if you read his writings carefully. Paul was very complimentary of women just as much as he was of men. And Jesus had, if you study the life of Christ, he surrounded himself, of course, with the 12 disciples, all men. But you look at his personal life, and he had a lot of friends that were women that were close to him. Mary and Martha are a good example of that. And apparently women were attracted to him at some level if they were positive. I'm not saying physically, but they were attracted to him because of the teaching. And you study the life of Christ, and you don't see him ignoring women or treating them, you know, except for that one woman he said, you know, you dog. But that wasn't because she was a woman. He was challenging her faith. It wouldn't have mattered if that would have been a man, but it happened to be a woman. So E.F. Fiorenza here, a major spokesman for the movement, says a feminist theological hermeneutic of the Bible that has as its canon the liberation of women. Ah, see, you women didn't know this. You need to be liberated. From what? Sexist texts, structures, institutes, and the internalized male value. We maintain that solely those traditions and texts of the Bible that transcend their patriarchal culture and the time and time have the theological authority of revelation. In other words, what she's saying here, if you're not following this, is that when she reads the Bible, she determines if the text transcends what's supposed to be said, what this male-dominated world. By the way, it's not only a man's world, ladies. Let me break this to you gently. It's not only a man's world, it's a right-handed man's world. So if you're a man and you're left-handed, things are not set for you even. And if you're a left-handed woman, there's no help for you. You're all backwards in a man, right-handed man's world. Well, I speak a little as if insane because I'm trying to make a point. She says we can only listen to those texts that transcend what we perceive to be cultural biases. And if it says anything about a man being in charge, that's a cultural bias because that was written by a man. I'd expect men to say that. Of course, they're in charge. What's the Bible say? Oh, the man's in charge. So everybody thinks, or at least some of these people do, this is all geared towards men. Well, trust me, it's not. And being in charge ain't all it's cracked up to be sometimes. You know, it's good to be the king. Not always. Not always. And so, but she thinks it would be good to be the king. I can tell you from her thoughts here. She thinks it would be good to be the king. And she wants the right to be the king. Even though no one wants a woman king. We might want a woman president. We're not sure yet. So anyway, she says that if this does not transcend this, and she determines what transcends this. Of course, that's the nature of interpreters. They say, we have the final say on this. If the Bible should not continue to be a tool for the patriarchal oppression of women. Ah, now we get to it. The Bible is a tool for oppressing women. Now she has betrayed her bias. She doesn't accept the Bible as the revelation of God for mankind, all mankind, men and women both. She says the Bible's used to oppress women. Now, has the Bible been used to oppress women? Probably. But hasn't our Constitution been used to oppress women? Aren't all kinds of things used to oppress women? That doesn't make them right or wrong. Sometimes people take something that's legitimate and use it in a wrong way. Have men ever used their authority to oppress their wives in a wrong way? Sure. So what people then want to say is, we got to throw authority out. The problem is authority. No, the problem's not authority. The problem's abuse of authority. And so, you know, you don't want to become like the modern liberal. Guns are bad. Therefore, we got to get rid of guns. People use guns to shoot each other. They use knives to stab each other. We got to get rid of guns and knives. They use clubs to kill each other. Got to get rid of clubs. They use ropes to hang each other. Got to get rid of rope. You know, whatever it is, however men can abuse things. Or women, society, they want to get rid of it. They want to throw out the baby with the bathwater. Well, A, their only solution is to transform the Bible by passing it through the grid of feminism, i.e. a feminist reading. In other words, we've got to read the Bible in a new way. We can't read it the way we've been reading it, because the way we've been reading it has really oppressed women. And so therefore, we can't read it that way. B, anything that reflects biblical patriarchalism is to be rejected. Therefore, God is often referred to by the pronoun she. And Jesus, the term father. And you hear this reflected, you know, I've heard it even reflected in songs. I wonder what God's like. I'd like, tell me if you meet her. God's not a her. One of the modern songs, I can't remember who made it. Jesus' use of the term father for God is not taken as proof that one should speak of God in the masculine gender. Now, how many of you women sit around every day when you're praying and think, my God, I should be referring to you as she? This never occurs to you, probably. Never occurs to me. And so why would it occur to this woman, you think? She's got an agenda. And her agenda is to undermine the Bible because the Bible promotes things she doesn't like. But she says she's here to defend the faith. Well, I've got to take her seriously. She's a defender of the faith. No matter how weird her theology, no matter how heretical her viewpoints, she's got to be given equal time. No, she doesn't. I'm only reading all this to tell you that I have listened to what these people say, and I've thought through their arguments. C, propelled with a zeal to correct what they believe to be centuries of injustice. Feminist interpreters have radically challenged traditional views in the places and roles of women and men. D, they openly reject the interpretations which assert that the husband is to rule in the home and that only men can serve as pastors and deacons. Those two things are completely out. So they've got, again, you have to rewrite the Bible at a certain level. E. Fiorenza further asserts that the norm for interpreting the Bible cannot be found in the Bible itself, but only in and through the struggle for the liberation of women and all oppressed people. So the man is keeping us down, and he's using the Bible to do it. Therefore, if we're ever going to get free of the man, we've got to get rid of the Bible. Or if we're going to keep the Bible, we've got to look at it a new way. We got to take a new hermeneutical approach to this. Well, every one of those statements is all so radical that you probably wouldn't even accept them. You know, even on the face value. And let's look at how we've used the Bible to oppress women all these years. Let's look at the Muslim culture and let's look at the Christian culture. Which one you women rather live in? You rather live in Western century Christianity, latter century Christianity, or would you rather be a Muslim woman? And you talk about using religion to oppress women. This goes on in all kinds of cultures. But the fact is, I would say Christianity has made the greatest strides in treating women as equals with men. And I think the Bible makes that plain that that's the way it's supposed to be at a certain level. Again, this doesn't mean authority doesn't exist. But it does mean that women are recognized as having every bit of an ability to apply doctrine and lay up divine good and be encouragements and all that as any man has. Just because you can't occupy the office of pastor teacher doesn't hamstring you in terms of spiritual growth and ultimate glory. It's just a different niche. We have different niches. That would be my answer quickly to all of their complaints is, wait a minute, just because we say we have different niches doesn't mean we think we're better. It doesn't mean we're trying to oppress you or keep you down. It just simply means that this is the reality of it. We have different niches. And God, our argument would be, God's designed it that way. We didn't. Do you think men designed the world? Men didn't have anything more to say about it than women do. God designed the world. God designed the authority structures. We didn't. But again, then people want to take these weird positions, I think, very weird, toss the Bible out, and now she categorizes any oppression of women with, well, we're just a part of all big people out here being oppressed. Whoever they are, all oppressed minorities. I'll tell you who the oppressed minority is, me. The middle class white man. Well, things are geared in this world a certain way. And you have to recognize that. You have to be shrewd as a believer and recognize the world is the way it is. And operate within the function, within the form that's there. You can't just say, well, okay, here's the way I'd like the world to be, so therefore I'm going to do this because I want the world to be this way. You either function within what you have or you don't function at all, seriously. Okay, well, time's up. We'll stop there and be ready to continue on here on Wednesday. Thank you, Father, for the privilege of studying these things. May God the Holy Spirit challenge us and continue to guide us in all the truth, for we ask it in Christ's name. Amen.